Hello, I'm Professor Bob Hewish from the Department of International Development Studies at Dalhousie University. You're listening to GDP, the Global Development Primer, the podcast dedicated to all issues in international development studies. Follow me on Twitter at Professor Hewish. Thanks again for joining us in the Global Development Primer podcast. And for this episode, we're joined by Kate Schechter. And Kate joined World Neighbors as the president and CEO in June of 2014. Now, World Neighbors is a 71-year-old international development organization that works with rural isolated communities to help find solutions to permanently lift these communities out of poverty. Dr. Schechter is responsible for managing World Neighbors programs and operations in 14 countries that are in Asia, Africa, Latin America, and the Caribbean. In her previous position, she worked for the American International Health Alliance for 14 years. And as a senior program officer at the AIHA, she had responsibility for managing health partnerships throughout Eurasia and Central and Eastern Europe. She worked with over 35 partnerships addressing primary health care, chronic disease management, hospital management, maternal child health, tuberculosis, blood safety, and HIV/AIDS. Now, with a very robust portfolio in international development and experience, we're happy to have Dr. Kate Schechter join us this week on GDP to help us predict what's lying ahead in 2024. Kate, thanks for joining us on GDP.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you back. You are a seasoned veteran of this podcast, so we're very happy to bring you back on board. And you know, here we are sort of rounding the first few weeks of 2024. And my big, broad crystal ball question to you is the year ahead in global development. What can we expect?
Well, you know, obviously that is a crystal ball kind of question, and nobody can really predict. But what I think we unfortunately can predict is more of the same, in the sense that both wars in Ukraine and in Israel and Gaza are continuing here in January, and neither seems to have a real clear end in sight. So that is unfortunately something that you don't have to be, you know, you don't have to be a fortune teller to know that those are going to continue on, at least in the short term. And I think what we can be pretty confident of is this process that we've seen quite a bit of in the last year, of countries going through a kind of continuation of decolonization. We saw in West Africa in 2023 a huge coup d'etat in Niger, which really kind of shook the whole region. And we saw yesterday that the West African countries of Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger detached themselves from the ECOWAS agreement, which is an economic kind of agreement amongst the West African countries. And in fact, this morning I was talking to our regional director in West Africa, and he was saying that part of the reason that they made that decision to detach or to resign from the coalition is that they are very, very frustrated with the French and upset with the French, and that ECOWAS continues to be run by the French. So that whole process of trying to move away from former colonizers is still very much at play throughout the world. And I think it's linked to what has been a big effort on the part of USAID and of many organizations, including our organization, to have what USAID is calling a more localized effort to work with community-based organizations and other types of local organizations in the countries, and to create more capacity on the ground. World Neighbors has been, my organization, World Neighbors has been focusing on that process for almost 75 years. So we've been very aware of the need for localization for a long, long time. We can see that focus on creating capacity, on transferring funds to local organizations that really know best what to do with grant funds is very much at play still. So those are some of the things. I'll just mention one other thing, which, I mean, is sort of, you might say it's obvious, but it isn't always so obvious in international development projects, which is income generation and livelihoods generation. This is a big effort that we make around the world, and we focus particularly on women and helping them to save funds so that they can start their own businesses and get loans to expand their we work in rural areas, so primarily with farmers, so to expand their farms as well.
Very, very interesting. And, you know, a lot of the focus on localization is something that we hear is continuing to be important, as it has been since the inception of global development. And yet I want to try to position that in what you've kind of highlighted here as sort of an era of increasing violence that, like you say, there's the continuing war in Ukraine, which is expanding in very bizarre ways. I mean, like, you know, there's naval campaigns now in the Black Sea. There's Eastern European nations that are Estonia, Latvia, Poland that are now militarizing and you know, trying to find ways to get people drafted into service. Of course, the Middle East conflict going on right now. We've seen now that the U.S. has promised a response against the drone attack in Jordan. We've seen Pakistan even have an engagement with Iran a couple of weeks ago, but also in Ecuador, there's been some violence that's taken place there in recent weeks that we've just had a previous guest on the podcast mention that a lot of it has to do with sort of the deeper conditions of development and poverty that's driving people to take such high risks to participate in gangs or narco trafficking. Is that something that is consistently driving this conflict up, or is it unrelated?
Oh, I totally agree that it is very much a driver of the rise in violence. I mean, what we've seen in West Africa is that young men are not finding jobs. And the terrorist organizations, the fundamentalist organizations, are offering them a way out. And that's why you see the persistence of these. I mean, it's not gangs so much in West Africa. It's more of these fundamentalist terrorist organizations. But I mean, you see it everywhere in Nepal. I don't know if you saw, but there's some Nepali young men are going to Russia because Russia is funds, and they're dying there on the front with Ukraine. So, that to me spells it out more than anything else. People are joining these gangs, these military, troops, whatever kind of violence you want to name, mostly because they don't see any other form of income that they can, or jobs that they can find. As I said earlier, I think a very important component going forward has to be on generating income producing activities, jobs, very, very sort of, farms that are not just subsistence level farms, but that produce enough so that the farmers can sell their products, their crops, their whatever, livestock, whatever it is that they're growing. I think, and for women especially, I think that income generation is key to their gaining more of a voice in society, having more power, not just at home, but in the communities and in politics. It's a key to everything. One of the frustrations I've had with development, the development sphere for a long time, is that there isn't enough, I feel, enough focus on savings. a lot of organizations, a lot of granting foundations want you to spend the funds that they give you in a pretty rapid fashion. So say you get a grant for 2 years, you're supposed to spend out the funds. You can't, you know, save the funds for later. And that also kind of transfers to a culture in which we're going into communities and spending money as rapidly as we can. And we're not creating a culture of savings. And that's something that World Neighbors has a big focus on. And we save in the United States. We teach our children to save money. You want to buy some expensive game? Well, you're going to have to save up your money to buy it. And we don't do that enough, I think, in development. I think
that's kind of brilliant. Like it's really hiding in plain sight, isn't it? I mean, you've hit it right on the head that people take these enormous risks. They put their bodies, their lives, their souls in these brutally compromising positions because of desperation, because there's nothing there. I mean, if you are without savings and you are relying on credit and someone else's credit and they're calling the shots, the many countries that are sending people through mercenary tactics to Russia right now is just unbelievable. There's even Cubans over there, right? There's a lot of people going to this. And here in Canada, and I know in the US and other parts of Europe as well, we're seeing a homeless crisis break out all over the place for essentially the same reasons, that there's no savings. People have no resources, and that puts them in such extreme vulnerability.
Exactly. We know that in Canada and the US, you can be a teacher and still be homeless because your salary isn't enough to cover rent or forget trying to buy a place. I think we really need to sort of change gears in development and start to look more at this issue of savings. We finally kind of understood that microfinance is not the way to go, that $100 might not be that much money to you and me, but to somebody who has zero, it's a lot of money. And if they can't pay it back to the bank, then they're in trouble, whether it's $100 or $1,000. So that whole perception that microfinance, because it was small amounts of money, was somehow going to solve the poverty problem has really moved forward, I think, into a understanding that there has to be some kind of community support for people who are getting loans. And if they do it together in savings and credit groups, then there's much less risk involved per person. What if the person is a widow and they get sick and they can't pay back their loan? Well, if they're in a savings and credit group, they can then rely on the community to support them until they're able to pay it back. I think savings is important. Maybe we shouldn't go down this rabbit hole, but World Neighbors and I am not fond of cash transfers. While I believe that, there are many things that governments should support that they don't always have the capacity to support, I don't know that filling that gap with a cash transfer is the solution, because it's...
Could you just explain what you mean by cash transfer?
Well, there's a whole sphere now in international development in the United States. And somebody at Harvard has actually won a MacArthur Genius Award for her work on this idea of giving people cash as opposed to creating programs where you train them and develop capacity through training. And it's becoming quite popular. So it's something that, there's a real debate about in the development environment. And we do help our communities to go to their municipal governments and to do two things. One, show them what they've accomplished without their support. So say we're in a very poor village in Nepal. And we are doing some really great work with the community, and they've been able to save money and invest in building schools creating a better sanitation system. We will help them to go to their municipal governments, their local governments, and try to get support from the local government, because those are things, you know, running water, having good sanitation, electricity, getting on the grid, those kinds of things should be provided by the government. But in many of these places, of course, people don't have access to those kinds of things.
In some cases, you had international volunteers just coming in as study abroad projects to build that crucial infrastructure, and often without Red Seal certification. So this is why you're kind of chronically rebuilding the very same thing again and again.
But if you get the government, whether it's local or national governments, to invest in their communities, generally speaking, that works better than an outsider coming in and doing a one-shot deal. So that's something that we do. And part of this whole discussion about cash transfers is sort of replacing, say there's a place where mothers really need to get some sort of a welfare benefit that the government simply can't provide. So the cash transfer helps, you know, new mothers, something like that. It's a one-time assistance. It could last for a few years, but it's certainly not a sustainable way to keep new mothers in, you know, to help them. And that's where World Neighbors would argue, okay, yes, people do need some help from the government. And let's figure out how we can tap resources that may not have been tapped yet. We work in very rural parts of India, in Bihar. And there again, we're seeing that these villagers, primarily women, simply don't know about the benefits that they are entitled to. India is such a complex country. It's so huge. You have pockets of extreme wealth and then pockets of some of the poorest people on earth. And so one of our jobs that we see is to help these very poor communities access benefits that they are entitled to.
And so exactly, I mean, that's a fantastic point. And to go back to, say, poor, younger, unemployed men, where would they fit into the equation?
Well, one of the fascinating phenomena that we're seeing in Nepal is that more and more the men are staying at home. So when I first started going to Nepal a decade ago, there were no men around. We'd go to these villages and it was all these women. And we were teaching them to farm. We were teaching them about savings and credits. We were teaching them all these things that we've talked about this morning. And we weren't really accessing men enough, I felt, because they were all in the Gulf states sending home remittances. And more we are seeing that the men are coming home. They're seeing these thriving farms. They're seeing opportunities to make money. And we have, you know, dozens and dozens of testimonials where people are saying, I'm actually making more money at home than I was making in the Gulf states. Plus, I'm with my family now. You know, I don't have to live in these terrible conditions. So the key to prevention, I truly believe this, the prevention of migration from the Central American states, from these places where you see mass migration problems, is to create incomes, jobs, job security of some sort. And the way that's going to happen is through community development. People need to work together. If they work individually, they could have a lot of success for a while, but as soon as there's an extreme weather event or something terrible happens to them, they're on their own. They don't have a community to support them. So I think we've seen over and over again that involving women and also creating more secure jobs are two ways to prevent violence and to create disincentives for migrating out of the countries.
And savings as well. Are there tangible mechanisms to try to increase programs for the savings that you talked about earlier that would be so crucial to bring that sort of meaningfulness into those livelihoods?
Absolutely. So savings and credits is sometimes it's called savings and loans groups, that they're really catching on all around the world. And the Gates Foundation has started to do more and more investing in that mechanism of savings and credits. Now, in the case of World Neighbors, it starts out at a very grassroots level with small groups putting in a small amount of money every week, and then gradually getting to a point where they have enough to loan to each other at very, very minimal interest rates. So it's not only that they're saving money, they're learning financial literacy, they're learning about, you know, managing finances. And what we see, I was honestly, when I first got to World Neighbors, I was a little skeptical about all of this. I'd never heard of it. And it seemed so sort of small scale grassroots to me, coming from Washington and you know, big USAID projects. Well, I have been shocked at the amount of money that small groups of people can save in very, very rural, difficult circumstances. I love to use the example of having gone to Timor-Leste, to an area of Timor-Leste that's very isolated, really not conducive to agriculture because it's very rocky and they have droughts every year. We drove for hours up into the mountains, and I couldn't help myself. I thought, wow, how can anybody live here? And we get to this small village, and we sit around, and everybody's giving their story to us. And one guy gets up and he said, okay, well, this year we saved $36,000. Wow. And I thought, where are you keeping that $36,000? So, and that's just one small example. And so very quickly you go from kind of a lockbox that, you know, is being passed around and held by the community members to needing to create community cooperative banks. We see that we're starting to see a whole sort of evolution that occurs where you start small and then you move to a level of agricultural cooperatives and community banks. We're talking about places for the most part where there are no banks. So they are creating a banking system for the poor rural farmers that, you know, doesn't exist in many of these places.
Very, very interesting, Kate. I mean, it's something that I think we hear a lot in global development about the importance of these concepts. And I know that as an educator in the field, sometimes those core lessons kind of get pushed aside and newer and trendier approaches get brought in, or there's a current crisis that seems to have no solutions available to it. But kind of returning to the basics here touches on so much about what simple means of developing those spaces at community levels to promote independence, to promote that cooperation, and how that in itself fends off some of these more ugly forces and processes that are seemingly to consume the planet at the moment.
Absolutely. I think, you know, you touched on several things. I mean, we say we want to have an exit strategy. We say that we want these communities that we're working in to become autonomous. We really need to put our money where our mouth is. There should be an exit strategy from day one. There should be an understanding with the community that we're not staying forever. Dependence creates resentment over time. We know that for a fact. And it makes sense. People want to be able to move forward on their own. One thing that we've been doing more of, in because World Neighbors is approaching its 75th anniversary, is doing evaluations of former communities to understand what are the factors that help sustain the changes that were started through World Neighbors, and how do these former communities grow and improve. And I've been thrilled to, I just went to Southern India, to Karnataka, to visit with communities that we worked with in the 1980s and 90s. Oh my gosh. I mean, the level of the standard of living is so impressive now. Now, of course, it's not just world neighbors, of course. I mean, you know, we're talking about 20, 30 years of 40 years of economic development in that region that has improved the lives of people tremendously. But a lot of the people that we spoke with who had worked with us and gotten training in the 80s and 90s told us that they felt that they wouldn't be sitting there talking to us. If one guy said this wonderful thing, he said, you know, if you'd given me $5,000, I wouldn't be sitting here today talking to you. So it's not about handing him some money. It's about giving him the training that allowed him to grow this incredibly impressive farm with them. One of the things that we saw there was a solar powered cold room that they had built in the fields so that they could harvest grapes and keep them cold in this room and then ship them when they were ready to. All kinds. I mean, we just saw a lot of really impressive stuff, but I've seen that all around the world. I've seen these communities move from really subsistence level to being lucrative consultants who, you know, who are really living at a very middle class. And it's in the case of this Karnataka groups, I would say upper middle class standards of living.
Well, Kate, I think this has been a very refreshing reminder that in 2024 going ahead, we are likely to hear a lot of nasty, ugly, violent things that are going to be occupying our geographical imagination. And in there is still opportunity to work with communities to value things like savings, to return to these basic principles that you say, that looking in the rearview mirror 20, 30 years later, 40 years later even, there are benefits that grow out of it. And that's a real important lesson for anyone who's either studying or practicing global development to be mindful of, that, you know, there is opportunity there. It's not just these block decades of violence and misery. There are opportunities that do come out of it. And I think to your earlier point, you know, cash is not the solution. You know, there's a reason when you go into a bank, they clearly say, would you like a checking account? Would you like a savings account or cash? And those are three very, very different things that don't always cooperate. But I think, I'll just ask you for any final thoughts before we wrap up the episode.
Well, I don't want to sound like Pollyanna here. I do think that, you know, as we started this conversation, there's still really big challenges ahead. But I think it's really important as we move forward as a development community to keep those, as you say, the sort of, you know, the things that are right in front of our noses, keep them at the forefront so that we don't get into this kind of rhetoric of despair, I would call it, and to really think about what works and how we can build on that.
Thank you much, Kate Schechter. Join us today. She is she's CEO of World Neighbors, and she's offered some insight today about just where the real values of development are, be it in 2024, a year that will likely see more extremes when it comes to violence and inequities, but still the continuation of seeing how important commitment to community values can be. Thanks again, Kate.
Thank you.